A listener production.
Okay, are you recording?
Howdy, good people. Welcome along to episode 172 of the Howie Games Part A, featuring a remarkable person by the name of Harry Garside. Now, Harry is a boxer, but Harry defies every single stereotype you could have about boxing and boxers.
To your winner from the blue corner. Yeah!
Harry is just 25 years of age, but he is a very wise head on young shoulders. A couple of hours with Harry left me asking myself questions about how I'm living my life and what I should look at changing, just what I should be doing to change things up a bit. Only a short intro for this episode, though, because I am that keen for you to get your ears around life according to Harry Garside, a man that challenges himself every single day.
So when you search and then you find and know just where to go and thoughts that once used to cloud your mind, you see clearly and now you know mystery, what is to be revealed in King Selassie. Come on children, trot with me, we want to reach Mount Zion.
Welcome to the Howie Games Olympic bronze medalist, man about town, and now a cool cat that lives in Bondi who's got me rattled technically because he's arrived and I wasn't quite ready. Harry Garside, welcome to the Howie Games. Great to meet you in person, mate. How are you going?
Yeah, very well. Thank you so much for having me on. This is one of my favourite podcast shows. So
thank you.
Yeah, been a fan for a while, so honoured to be a guest.
I hear a lot on this podcast about being grateful, and I actually feel full of gratitude at the moment because I've come in here and I'm going to commentate a test match tomorrow. I love cricket. I'm in a beautiful hotel having a chat with a bloke that fascinates me. And I just had a feeling as I was coming in here and I was a bit rattled because the plane was late and I was trying to get set up that life is pretty good. Gratitude is a good thing. And I'm feeling it at the moment, having a chance to chat with you right now.
Yeah, it's one of those things. I actually, from this year, for the whole year, I'll do these little alarms. I hope one doesn't go off during this podcast, but I do these alarms and one of them is thoughts. There's about 20 alarms throughout the day and each one's a little bit different. But one of them's thoughts. And it's like if I ever catch myself in a negative thought while the alarm goes off or in the hours between the two alarms, I have to change it to something that I'm grateful for. So it actually happened when I was driving here. Right. It went off and I was like very frustrated. Couldn't find a park. It's a beautiful, beautiful summer day.
We're in Coogee.
And I was obviously a little bit frustrated, mate, but that alarm went off and I had to change it to something that I was grateful for. And I was just grateful that I was driving down and I could see the ocean and living in a spot like this, you mean? And I'm grateful that everyone else, including myself, is enjoying this beautiful summer's day. So
how often do the alarms go off in the day?
So there's probably 20 to 25 alarms and each one's a little bit different. Like scattered every maybe hour, 45 minutes or something like that.
And just if you're having a negative thought, so if you're thinking positively, you just push on. But if you've got a negative thought, right, it's time to think of something positive.
Yeah, and obviously as humans, I think we're hardwired to think about the negative for survival. So there will always be there's probably three thoughts alarms, which is specific to that one, the negative thoughts. So there would 100% most likely be a negative thought within that time bracket that I will need to change. Say something, you had a fight with your partner or you're thinking about the future and just trying to change that attitude. And I think that was, for me at the Olympics, it was probably the thing that I lost before I got in the ring because of the negative thoughts. So if I can change it a little bit over the course, then I think I'll be a better boxer and a better person.
I'll come back to what those thoughts were when we get to your boxing journey. A lot of positivity in the room because you have just come from, I reckon, my favourite place on the east coast of Australia, Crescent Head. Now, if people haven't been, this is what was your experience in Crescent Head? Like, I go there for the surf, but great pub, great bowls club there as well. You get a good Palmer in there if you need to. Great caravan park. What were you doing in Crescent?
It was my second time there. I was there a couple of years ago on New Year's Day. Coincidentally, it's the same day that I was there this year. But it was it's just an amazing place. I had to show my partner. She's never camped before, and I grew up camping.
So it's your first camping trip.
First camping trip.
So are you still together now?
Yeah, we are only just.
Oh God.
I set up a swag in the middle of nowhere, in the middle of a bush. and in Crescent somewhere. It was about 10 minutes out of town, but
Point Plumber Road.
Yeah. So I just had to show her Crescent. It was one of my favourite beaches in Australia. So I'm yet to do WA. I've heard there's some beautiful beaches over there, but Crescent on the east coast is by far my favourite.
How did you both go with the camping? Did you meet a middle ground? It's not an easy thing, camping.
It's not. She I give it to her. She's tough as nails. She is tough as nails, and she's very adaptable. And it was a beautiful experience. I could tell she much prefer. She was saying she couldn't go to sleep. So I'm very easy. I could sleep on concrete, mate. But she was saying she couldn't get to sleep till about 12. I was asleep by 10. I'm thinking, how good. And she's thinking, she was telling me in the morning, she's having all these thoughts like, this is why humans created houses. She was having all those thoughts. She finally got to sleep. And then she woke up pretty late for her. So it was a good experience.
Where did you dine in Crescent, or did you do camp cooking?
No, we dined. I'm not much of a cook, Howie. I like to think I am, but right. It's very basic.
Was it at the pub, or at the bowls club, the little cafe, the bakery? What did you do?
So we actually got there pretty late, so there wasn't much open. We went to the bakery in the morning. It is fantastic.
Elite.
Yeah,
elite
my partner actually said it was her favourite bakery.
Very good bakery she's ever been to.
So big statement from her. But we went to the Chinese restaurant in the country club. Yeah, it was the only thing open.
The country club.
Yeah, only thing open.
you mentioned when you walked in here that you've only recently moved to Bondi for love, which is a beautiful thing. And you said to me, even though you're 25, as we get, you know, when you're 10 and 12, you make friends like that. And you said it took you a while to sort of find your crew here in Bondi.
Yeah, it's interesting. Obviously, as a 25-year-old, a lot of the people I grew up with, what are they doing on the weekend? They're usually going out to a pub. They're experiencing life as a 20-year-old, and I totally get that. But as an athlete, you mean, I very rarely drink. I very rarely go out. I very rarely eat bad food. So it's a little bit challenging and to make new friends. And thankfully, though, I've been really grateful over the last sort of 4 months. There was probably about 5-6 months period where I was like, I was getting a bit lonely, mate. Like, yeah, the only person I felt I had was my partner and a couple of others. But finally,
which puts pressure on that relationship as well when you're all invested there with no one else to be a circuit breaker.
Yeah, very true. And I found myself that she was my girlfriend. She was also the person that my psychologist at times. She was the person who I was bouncing things off. So it was challenging for both of us. But thankfully, over the last sort of 3-4 months, I've really connected with some beautiful people, and I found that there's not many people in my 20s that I'm mates with. A lot of them are in their 30s, 40s, they've got kids, but they're very active and they're very out there and really good people. So I'm pretty grateful that I've met them, and I think 2023 for myself, I'll finally start to feel like this is my home.
I hope so. Well, what do you look for in potential new friends? I have this, I joke with my wife, end of the year, around Christmas time, she always says, right, so who was your friend of the year? So it's someone you've met during the year that you hadn't met before that made a real impact on you. And this year, I need to tell him, it's a fella called Paul Raff. Just a local bloke, met him, but on my wavelength, he owns a peanut butter factory. Just a good local dude. So what do you look for in a potential new friend?
That's a great question. I've never really thought about it, but I think it's a feeling, you know. But at the same time, they've got to have this similar characteristics to myself. They've got to love outdoors. They've got to be very active. And you mean, obviously, I train a lot. I love physical exercise and moving my body, but just a genuine person. And you mean, I feel like I grew up, I wouldn't say it's country, but I grew up, you mean, an hour from the city, very working class. And I've found throughout my travels, I traveled a lot when I was a kid. So I found throughout my travels, country towns, what they say is what they mean. And in city towns, it's a little bit different. You mean people have their own agenda. They've got their own goggles on for their own life. And that's totally fine. I get it. But I found a lot of country people are just very genuine, very authentic. So I try and find that within people. And I've actually met some people who are local Bondi, Clove Valley people. So they've been here for 40 years. They're the locals before the massive flux of people and money come here. So really genuine. And what they say is what they mean, which I think is a very valuable thing.
I love what you say about the country. I grew up in a small country town, and there's definitely a different attitude to folks from the country. I so much want to talk to you about training, but just let's first touch on, so I've had 3 pro fights. We'll get to the Commonwealth Games and the Olympics, and congratulations, by the way, what you did in both those, but 3 pro fights, you've got 3 wins under your belt. Is there a next fight? Like, are you training to fight now?
Yeah, so I've I'm pretty grateful we get to both do amateurs and professionals. So I'm actually going for two tournaments in Europe in February.
Right.
In the amateur team. So the first one's in Hungary, and then the next one's in Bulgaria.
Right.
And then I come back, and 2 weeks later, I fight professionally. So it's
so you can go back and forth. So previously, you compete at the Olympics, then when you turn pro, you can't come back. But now you can go back and forth, can you? I didn't realise that.
Yeah, you can finally do it. But it's one of those things. It is like long distance running and short distance running. It's like they're very different.
Right.
So three rounds, you fight over a tournament, you lose your route, very, very similar to tennis.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's just one of those, you're very fast paced amateur boxing. You're probably not going in there to hurt people as much. It's not, you're not putting on a show. You're just trying to win. It's very competitive. Where professional boxing is 10, 12 rounds. You're in there. It's prize fighting. So you're in there just sort of, I don't know, put on a show, and it's a bit more of a spectacle.
And you have to train differently for the, you know, obviously 12 rounds compared to three rounds.
Yeah, there is a difference within training. So I'll definitely, most of the amateur team, or probably all of the amateur team besides myself, throughout those two tournaments, they'll be doing, after say they lose or say they, will do sparring, and they'll probably only do four rounds because it's a three-round fight, where I will do 6 to 10 rounds in those times where I'm able to do sparring and not competing, just because I know I've got to do a professional fight in a month's time. So it'll be interesting to see. I've never done it before. But it'll be interesting to see how I go with sort of mixing it up, because I actually think the greatest athletes are the ones that can adapt the most.
Yep.
The ones that they're not just set in a certain way. They can mix up the way they fight. They can change. And, that's why I think he's someone like a Michael Phelps, one of the best swimmers ever. He could do almost any distance. Absolutely. Realistically. So, that's what I want to try and do. And it'll be very interesting. And I think it's important for me because I've got to make a decision if I try for the Olympics. Try to make the Olympic team in 2024, or I focus on my professional career. So I think this will be the sort of decider.
And obviously, when you fight professionally, you're still representing your country, but I saw the pride that you had in representing Australia at the Commonwealth Games and the Olympics. What's it mean when you're going out and fighting for your country and your countrymen, as opposed to yourself with your country involved?
Yeah, it's a completely different mindset.
Is it?
And that's something that I've really struggled with, in the sense of, a lot of athletes now, they talk about purpose. And I'm reading a book right now, what's it called? The All Blacks one, I forget what it's called, Legacy.
Yeah.
I think that's what it's called. Fantastic book. I'm about two chapters in. But it's pretty much about purpose, the bit that I'm on right now, and how important it is for an athlete. The days that are hard, the times where you don't get the results you want, if you don't have a strong enough purpose, you'll probably stay down or you won't try again. So for me in my Olympic journey, my purpose was seeded when I was a kid. It's so easy, and I was so present, and I was so aware of what it was. Grant Hackett swimming the 1500 meter final 2004. I'm 7 years old, amazed by that moment.
Gold to Australia. Grant Hackett wins.
John Aloisi, Mark Schwarzer in 2005.
Oh, big great save again by Schwarzer.
Huge save.
Wonderful save. Here's Aloisi for a place in the World Cup.
For us.
He scores.
Matthew Mitchum, Steve Hooker in 2008. Moments like this really sort of built this foundation and this purpose that I just wanted to be just like them. And I've turned professional, and of course it's great. I'm earning money.
Yep.
And I want to be world champion, but I'm just trying my best to latch myself to a purpose. What am I doing it for? And it needs to be bigger than myself. And I'm fully not locked on a purpose yet, but that's one of my goals in the first 3-4 months of this year, is to be locked in, because the times when it's hard, the times when it's challenging in my professional career, and I'm sure there's going to be plenty. You need to have a strong enough why, or else you probably won't strive as hard, or you won't want it as much.
It's funny you mentioned the Olympians. We've been really lucky on this show 6 months ago. It was getting a bit beyond me, the podcast, to take on a guy called Tommy Dullard, who I used to work with at Fox Footy, but you ran across at the Commonwealth Games. He was working for Seven. And he told me a story that I can't believe Ian Thorpe's working on the coverage. And Tommy said, come and meet him. And he took you to meet Thorpe. And he was saying that you had posters on your, I think he said, Tommy told me, on your roof at home of Thorpe.
Yeah, so for about like 4 or 5 years prior to it was after the 2016 Olympics, I failed to make the team. And I was just obsessed. I'm obsessed. I'm very much like that extremist. And You should have seen my room. I really struggle to bring people in. I'm a bloody 20-year-old boy and I've got stuff that 8-year-old boys have.
Like
just photos of all my honoured favourite Olympians, not just Australian, mostly were Australian, but there was a lot of Michael Phelps, some of the greatest athletes of all time, Usain Bolt, just on my roof. And then there was also lots of Australian flags. There was inspirational quotes. I had a fake medal made up. I also purchased one before the 2020 Olympics, a fake gold medal that looked exactly like the gold medal. Yeah, just anything I could to be obsessed. And every time I woke up, I was jumping out of bed because I know what I'm doing it for. So to see Ian Thorpe, the greatest athlete we've ever had, and shake his hand, I was just very honoured.
It's funny you say that about as a 20-year-old. We were talking about making new friends. So if you meet a new fella at school or a girl comes around or whatever and they go into your room and what, you ooh, what's this Harry customer all about? Where's he at in the world?
Wow, he's an 8-year-old boy.
Boxing, where's it start? So you some eastern suburbs, Lilydale Way in Melbourne. Why boxing?
Yeah, I think I didn't really know when I was a teenager, but I have two answers for this. Is I watched too many Rocky films. Right. Which is 100% correct.
Well, what's your favourite?
The fourth by far. Yeah, third one's really good, but the fourth one's amazing
too.
When
he's training in Russia, the montage and Drago's high tech.
Oh, so good.
And he's out in the log cabin.
He's just chopping wood.
Tell me that's what you do in training, Harry.
It's an amazing film. We watched that so much. A big part of my story. I'm the youngest of three boys.
Yep.
And I obviously grew up in a place called Lilydale, very working class, a lot of men in my life. And I felt very different to them. They were always, my brothers especially, they were out the back playing with dad in the shed. And I was in touch with my mum and what my mum was doing. And my mum would go shopping, I'd go with my mum. I was very much a mama's boy. So for me, I felt a little bit different. I felt I didn't get much respect from my dad or my two brothers. And I started boxing purely to prove I was a man. I obviously didn't know that at the age of nine.
At what age? At nine?
At the age of nine.
So how do you start boxing at age nine?
Yeah, I had to ask my parents where a boxing gym was and mum really didn't want me to do it, but my dad, he was all about it. They just did a bit of research, I think a bit of word of mouth. They knew a gym in Lilydale and went down there, met my coach, who's still my coach today, Brian Levere.
Coach?
Yeah, he's in Melbourne, story. But I love him to bits. He will always be, he's like my granddad. He's obviously not blood related, but love him to bits. He's 80 years old this year. Exceptional man, but he. I walked into the gym at the age of nine and just fell in love with him and fell in love with the sport.
Why?
Why I fell in love with him? I think it's. I've really pondered this. I think it's really important for young people to receive positive love and positive affirmations from people who are outside of their family.
Mm-hmm.
Because I don't know if you're obviously when you're younger, your parents most likely will give you a lot of love, give you a lot of attention, and that's kind of their role. But when someone's doing it who's not in your family and you build this sort of special connection with coaches, teachers, people who are outside of your family, I just feel it was a different connection because it's not blood related. And for him, he made me, it's very similar to Mike Tyson and Gus D'Amato.
Yes.
He really made me feel special. He would say stuff like, your footwork is amazing. You're going to be world champion. Yeah, you're just exceptional. And I would always walk out feeling amazing. But I just found myself wanting to constantly impress him and make him happy and also make myself happy because he helped me build my confidence. So that's the reason why I fell in love with him.
And why did you fall in love with boxing?
It was just... It's probably the most meditative state. Obviously, I didn't know this when I was 9 years old, but when I'm in there, I have a lot of voices in my head. My brain is wired to just think wildly. And when I was younger, I found it a little bit harder to sleep and would think a lot. But then when I walked into the boxing gym and you do a hard 2-hour session, by the time you get home as a 9-year-old kid, you fall straight asleep. And I love the beauty of that. And obviously, when I'm inside that ring, the movement, the art form of it, and it's the most primitive, I think, place we can go as humans in this day and age. We're not animals anymore. Mm. We like to think we're not animals, but to get in there and to fight against another man or another person, it's a beautiful thing. And I think to do it in a controlled manner, I think you really exercise something that humans don't get to exercise anymore, that primitive, natural animal instinct type state.
And do you think it did what you were thinking you needed to do in front of your brothers and your dad?
Absolutely.
Did it?
Yeah, for sure. And I still catch myself around my mates or like the people I grew up with or playing a bit of a role. But it's I've definitely found over the last 18 months since the Olympics, especially, that I can be myself and people will love me for that, and people will also not like me for that. So, it definitely, I think in my era growing up, I was one of the only persons people that I knew that did boxing. So it gave me this sense of being unique, being special, being different. And when people think of boxers, most of the time they think of tough, you mean masculine type people.
Yep.
And I didn't feel like that on the inside, but then when people, you mean, had that idea of me, it made me feel good. So of course it did what I wanted it to. And then only in the last few years have I been able to show a bit more of my natural, authentic side, I guess.
So what was your first actual fight? Like, you train, and then when's your first fight? At what age?
So the laws in Victoria, I was 12.
Right. 12?
Yeah, I'll never forget it.
And be fair to say, pardon the language, you're not exactly built like a brick shit house. So I don't know what you were like at 12, Harry. Like, you fight at 60 kilos, don't you?
60, yeah.
60 kilos. Yeah. And how tall are you?
Just under 6 foot.
Okay. So you have to keep light. So you're going as a 12-year-old?
Yeah, it was I had all the gear. Every Christmas I'd just ask for boxing stuff. Every Christmas, birthday, I'd just ask for boxing stuff for parents, and they would always provide some amazing things. And I remember looking over, and this is a great lesson that I learned at the age of 12.
Yeah.
Never judge a book by its character.
Right.
And by its cover. Yep. And I looked at the guy who I was fighting, he was wearing runners. And he looked a bit sort of like podgy. I'm thinking, I'm gonna bash this guy. You know, I'm feeling great. Like, I've done all the work. I got in there, mate, and he punched the absolute, sorry for my language, the shit out of
Did
me.
He?
So yeah, it was an amazing. I had tears rolling down my face in the third round, 2 8 counts put on me. Finally got through it. Luckily got through it. But yeah, it was just a lesson to learn. Huh. Never judge a book by its cover. So
one fight, one loss.
One fight, one loss. I lost 10 out of my first 18 fights. I was pretty average, but just as I mentioned, my coach and many other reasons, I kept going back. And I think that's really important for people. If you love something, it doesn't really matter about the result. You just want to do it.
10 of your first 18 fights. What was your first win?
My third fight was my first win. And then, yeah, sort of staggered win, loss, loss, win.
And what does the feeling of winning the first time do to you?
No, it was amazing because it was quite humiliating. I had a lot of my friends, my brother's mates in my first fight.
Where are you fighting?
So it was in Brunswick in Melbourne. Yeah, it was just like it's called the Calabria Club in Brunswick.
Oh, I know the Calabria Club.
Yeah,
old school.
Yeah, old school. They used to host the fights under the ground. And
First one, all your crew went?
Yeah, all my crew. It was so embarrassing. I actually had my grade 5 crush there. She come along as well.
What was her name?
Brianna.
She was there. Yeah. You've got smacked in front of Brianna.
Absolutely. Beaten up, mate. But it's all part of
at least
it.
She was there.
Exactly right. So I had my family. Everyone was there. But just one of those things. I think for young people, I felt the embarrassment, the humiliation. But it's what you do when you lose, or what you do after, even when you win. The next decision you make is sort of shows what you like as a person. So I got up and I was at the gym the next day. Win, lose, or draw, I'm always at the gym the next day. So and then finally got better and better.
And the winning feeling, what does it mean to you, whether you're 12 or 23?
It's interesting. Andre Agassi, I just finished reading his book.
Open.
Fantastic.
I think the best sports book I've ever read.
It's fantastic. He really articulates things really well, but he has this, I'm going to butcher it, but it was winning never feels as good as losing feels bad.
Right.
Yeah, and I truly agree with that. It's an amazing feeling, and of course the big moments like the Commonwealth Games, the biggest win that I've ever had. To have that feeling, that elation in that moment, it's like ecstasy just getting jammed into your body, and then to watch, in the flag pulled up and the national anthem being played and having all my family and friends there, amazing moments. But the times that you lose, that's just like, it's the worst feeling. It rips a part of your soul out, and it's because you care so much.
Yeah.
And 2020, that was probably the worst loss that I've had, the most that I've felt. But I look back now, and when I was in it, I wanted nothing more than just to get out of that moment. It was the worst. But I look back now and it's so amazing that us as humans can care that much. I'm sure you can vouch when you see your kid triumph or fail, like that pain that I'm sure you feel. So it's an amazing thing that we can care that much about things.
We'll get to 2020 or 2021 as it was, but obviously you're talking about Tokyo. So you're progressing along, but you're also a plumber, yeah? So you have a trade,
I'm very average at that.
Well, but. See, this is my question, because I read that you're a plumber. Like, you know, if here at the Crown Plaza we sprung a leak now, can you fix it or not?
I'd probably call my brother, who's a qualified plumber, and he would tell me what to do. So right. that was the story of my life when I was a plumber. I worked with him.
So you were on the tools?
Yeah, I was on the tools. So I did about 2.5 years, and then
did you like it?
Oh, I did. It was nice to work with my brother. I worked with my dad as a roof tiler when I left school. So
your dad was a tiler.
Roof tiler,
that is
yeah.
a hard job.
Yeah,
I
and he's
imagine.
Still he's 50, 54, 55, and he's still
How's
on the
he
roof.
Back?
Oh, what? And he's a big man, my right. dad. But yeah, he's just one of the hardest workers I've ever met. So, yeah, I finished school, and my philosophy was, if it works for boxing, it works for me.
Okay.
I won my first nationals finally after failing a few times in 2015 in year 12, and then I finished school and boxing started to take off. And if it worked for boxing, it worked for me. And my parents are very big on once you turn 18, you provide for yourself. So they taught me many great, amazing lessons, and I worked with Dad for close to a year. And then I found a job with my brother as a plumber, who luckily it's just a little bit easier on the body, plumbing, compared to roof tiling. Roof tiling, you're out in the heat or you're carrying, it's just hard labor. So grateful I got the opportunities with both my dad and my brother. And yeah, as I said, I'm a very average plumber. But
so and with your tradies, the local survey where I am caters for the tradies, and there are some incredibly fit, healthy, well-fed tradies out there, but I've seen some of the tradies there in the V's and the dim sims. Were you bringing a nice standard of cuisine to your plumbing jobs or being a boxer? Surely you went a triple dim sim and 600 ml milk and a V to get you going through the day.
Yeah, there's definitely times where I wanted to be like them, but I was a lot of the time, 99% of the time, I was on the tuna and rice. So as I mentioned before, Howie, I'm not much of a cook, but yeah, just very basic. Rice, tuna, sometimes chicken.
And is
yeah,
that you
veggies.
Now? Is that you now? Like, are you, if 100% is completely dedicated to what you eat and 0% is you don't give a stuff, where are you, do you think, as an athlete?
Yeah, I would say probably about 85%, to be honest. Yeah, I know my body really well. Yeah. I'm the type of person who I obsess. And I found myself when making weight prior to the Commonwealth Games, it was probably one of the hardest weight cuts that I had done.
61.02 kilograms for Gasser.
And I'm pretty lean, so it
but,
was...
But naturally, in normal life, if you're a plumber, I think you'd be pretty similar to me, wouldn't you? Be sort of mid-70s, I reckon.
I've never seen over 70, yeah.
Right.
Yeah, so or maybe
but
70.
That's because you've been living a dedicated lifestyle.
Yeah, yeah. I think if I probably just like was
normal
wasn't training
dude.
As much. Yeah, yep. Yeah, absolutely. I think I'd be definitely mid to low, 70s. But
so you're 67, you've got to get to 60.
Yeah, yeah. And it was just one of those things. I found myself, this is how obsessive I got. I found myself at times getting up, walking to the toilet, and I'd be thinking, how many calories am I burning walking to the toilet? Like, I was obsessive, jumping on the scales 20 times a day every time after you drank or ate. Like, it was a little bit too much. And I found myself that if I start counting calories and start counting, measuring my food, I become really obsessive. So I've got to also know what works for me and what doesn't work for my sort of mental stability and mental health.
Yeah.
And that the stuff like that, when I'm obsessing about numbers and stuff like that, I really find myself sort of deteriorating negatively. So
how hard is it to get to 60?
I find it easy now. I know my body really well. Okay. Yeah, just through years of experience, I guess.
So then you weigh in. A lot of people don't realise this. So you get down to your 60, you weigh in. That's the only time. So that's normally 24 hours before the fight, yeah?
So in amateurs,
yep.
So that's Olympics and Comm Games, you weigh in the day you fight. Every day you fight, which
right.
is probably the challenge.
So as opposed to a pro where then you can go and have 3 bowls of pasta and build it up.
Yeah.
So throughout the entire Olympic campaign, or I think you fought maybe 6 times in the Commonwealth Games?
Five
times.
Yeah.
You have to, so you can't load up.
Can't load up, yeah. So it's like knowing that fine line. And that's probably a big difference between professional and amateur boxing.
So what would you fight at in your 3 pro fights? What are you weighing in at when you fight?
So when you weigh in 30 hours before you fight,
yep.
roughly. And I jumped on the scales when I left my house, so probably 2 hours before the fight. And I think I was 67 and I weigh in at 61.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah. So it's 6 kilos in 30 hours.
What are you having before your fight? What's your last meal?
Oh, it changes every time, but I always like to have a muesli bar. It's a bit of a tradition. I have a muesli bar, and I have this, I have lollies with me, but I never touch them for some reason.
Right.
But I just buy them, and they're just in my bag. So usually eat them after the fight, a couple of them. Yeah, it's always a muesli bar, and I sip on a Gatorade and sip on my water. So it's yeah, it's just a bit of a tradition. It's more of a routine, no superstitions. I've definitely fought without it. But yeah, just like I think it's super important to have a routine and know what you're doing. And also, if things happen, which often happens in every athlete's life, you know, sometimes the fight gets pulled before you or gets stopped and you have to go in earlier, or you need to be able to adapt really well. And I find the best athletes are the ones that can adapt the best. Definitely throughout my life, listening to a lot of Olympians and stuff like that.
So life, as disciplined as you are, there's positives and there's negatives. How do you steer through a life with such a level of discipline where you're actually thinking about calories when you're going to the loo?
Yeah, it's
is it a cross to bear or not?
Yeah, it's a blessing and a curse, to be honest. It's definitely, I found I've never been in a long-term relationship, mate. This is the first time that I've been dating my partner now for 18 months. It's not a super long-term, but it's the longest I've ever been in. So, and it's a mirror. When you're in a relationship, it's a mirror, and it's something that I've found a lot of the things that have helped me be successful, the obsessiveness and the extreme mindset and the highs and lows of sport, a lot of the things that have helped me be successful also are a detriment to my mental health at times and to my relationships and my friendships and my family relationships. So just I think it comes with maturity. I'm only 25, Howie, but slowly but surely I'm starting to navigate, like understanding how I take off that cap from being an athlete, a high-performing athlete who really cares about results and cares about being the best, but then also being a good human when I leave and not making sure I'm not being mean to the ones who mean the most, my family, my friends, or my partner. So it's been a beautiful journey the last 18 months. Definitely had its challenges, but it's just one of those things. I think coming of age, you start realizing these things. You mean, like, you can be a high-performing athlete, and you can also maintain relationships and maintain friendships as well.
You've spoke about your mum and your dad and your brothers, and part of becoming a high-profile person is various parts of your story come out. And I've heard you speak about, you spoke about one brother you worked with. I've heard you speak about another of your brothers who's had a tough run in life. Do you mind me asking you about that?
No, absolutely, mate.
So can you explain to me his situation and what effect that has or hasn't had on you and your family?
Yeah, it's actually really good right now. So, like, if you asked me this 2 years ago, I would have been probably bawling my eyes out. It really impacted my family the last 5 years, and last Christmas was amazing, mate. He was finally back. He's out of rehab at the moment temporarily. He sort of left prison, went to rehab. He was in rehab for about 10 months, and then he got to spend Christmas with his family, which was amazing. And after the year my mum's had, she got diagnosed with breast cancer, and that's all right. She's totally fine. And just to have him there, the whole family after 5 years finally together. So the three boys and my parents, I could just see mum's face glowing. So he's really good right now. He's just to go through that. And me personally, I feel super similar to him. I've always had a very addictive personality, and I'm addicted to things that are socially accepted, but they cause just as much pain. You mean being successful and having that drive, that addiction to success and validation and stuff like that, it causes just as much pain and misery, but it's socially accepted. People celebrate you, people tap you on the back. But in order for me to be successful, it's very isolating, very lonely. As I mentioned before, I'm super obsessive and I care about things a lot. So it's interesting just seeing a lot of myself in him and hating him for that, because there's a few things inside myself that I'm trying to manage. But then now to see how much growth he's put in over the last 5 years, or over the last probably year more so, just very proud of him. And he's finally back in the family, and we're always there. We never turn our back on him, but people in those situations, you mean, it's one of those times where, like, you need to set a boundary yourself. It's just challenging. And to see how that affects mum and dad, it's probably the worst for them, yeah. This is one of my alarms,
alarm?
Mate.
Yeah. All right. So what's the alarm telling us? What have we got?
So this is called King Energy. So,
right.
Well, I'll explain it on the...
Okay.
This is called King Energy, and this one is I close my eyes.
Yep.
And I just say a few positive things to myself. You mean, I'm enough, I'm world champion, I'm worthy of love, I'm powerful. It mixes every time, but there's a few similar ones all the time. And then I close my eyes and I vision the life that I want to see in 5-10 years. So I see myself holding a belt, I can feel it in my body. And then I also vision myself with family, with kids, you mean looking out over a beach, very similar to Coogee. So we'll pause it now. Is that all right if I just quickly do it?
Yeah, thanks, absolutely.
Sorry, mate.
No, you don't need to apologise. It's very I couldn't look at you because it felt too intimate to look at what you were doing. So I'll get back to the prison discussion. So you're obviously a believer that if you have in your mind where you want to go, that my wife's a big believer in this, that you can get yourself there.
Yeah, it's it probably, I'm the type of person, my mum, she's a medium, so she talks to dead people. She's very spiritual, always has been. And my dad's a roof tiler, so he's more right wing.
Mum's a medium.
Yeah, yeah. So growing up, she was always into tarot cards and very sort of crystals and stuff like that, and just a bit of hooly dooly sort of stuff. And I was a bit skeptical at the start, but also know my mum's not a liar. She fully believes it, and it's a beautiful thing if you believe something. So I'm a type of person, and one of the things I love most about myself is there's really not anything on this earth that I wouldn't try at least once. And yeah, it's one of those things. I don't know if it actually is scientifically proven, but there was a moment for me, and this has probably strengthened it for me. Every time I did this, I did this prior to the Olympics. Every time I did this, I could see myself on the podium, but I could never see myself in the middle. And I'd always close my eyes I'd open my eyes and I would shake it off and I'd go, come on, like really get there, see yourself in the middle. And after maybe a couple of minutes, I could finally get there and see myself in the middle. But it was amazing that I could see myself on the podium, but it was not in the middle. And I ended up obviously receiving a bronze. So, it's that sort of strengthened it for me. And if you want to envision things, it's like once you start visualizing it, I think you gravitate towards that. It's like you want a Range Rover. You'll be driving and you'll see Range Rovers everywhere.
Yeah.
This is the way the human mind works. So if you visualize something enough, I think you bring that. It obviously takes work and consistency and stuff like that as well, but you'll bring that into your life, I personally think.
You need to give yourself credit because at age 25, I was having this thought this morning about there's a few things happening and, all right, what do I want out of this situation? Like at age 25, if you'd said to me, visualise where you want to be in 10 years, I wouldn't have been able to do the process because I wouldn't have been able to tell you. So I think you're to be credited the fact. And obviously it's a simpler path for an athlete because there are set out goals. But to know, to have something at age 25 that you can visualise on, I think you're a step ahead of most in the game.
I appreciate that, Howie. Yeah, it's and I'm sure it will probably change when I have kids and stuff like that. But at the moment, the visions are certain things. And it's a really nice feeling to do that. And some days I don't want to do it. Some days I don't feel connected to it. But it's, I think discipline is doing the things you don't want to do, but do it like you love it. Mm. And doing it on the days where you don't want to do it. So it's just consistency. And I felt really connected to that one. And sometimes you can really see your future. You can really see the things that you want, and other times you can't. So it's a beautiful thing, and I'll continue to do it.
It'd be an interesting process though, because it'll be like a mental journal, because at some stage you'll wake up and you'll do it and the picture will be different in your head, and you'll realise your growth as a person, because you will go, if you continue to do it from your life, from wanting to stand on the top step of a podium to wanting to be X. It'd be a nice journey through your life.
Yeah, and that's a beautiful thing. At the moment, I never really wanted kids, but at the moment I can visualise myself and it's the future that I want, and I can see kids in it. So it's a beautiful thing, and I don't know when that time will come, Howie, but I'm sure it'll be sometime in my 30s most likely. But I'm sort of really excited for that. I think it's one of the most beautiful things we can do as humans is have kids, and I'm sure Penguin and Pickle, I'm sure they are two beautiful kids, and they bring a lot of joy to your life.
They do. And some heartache if they're listening. So did you go and visit your brother when he's in prison?
Yeah, so me and my brother personally, we had a really negative relationship for a long time. So, there was a lot of pain, a lot of misery. I found myself being his older brother at times. Mm. There was times that I saw him do some pretty hurtful things to the people that I love, my mom and my dad. And there was just a lot of built up anger and a built up frustration. Why can't you just be normal? You know what I mean? And I think throughout my journey, I finally sort of, you mature and you realize that he doesn't want to be like that.
Yep.
You know what I mean? No one chooses that. They don't. If he could wake up tomorrow and you'd say one wish, you mean you could be normal, I think it would be to be normal, to be with my family and to be healthy. He doesn't want to be like that, and I can see it in his eyes. And I just had to sort of realize that he's battling some things. And I never went to prison because we were in a negative state. But through probably the last 6 months, he got my number off my mum, and he was calling me probably every 3 weeks. So, and I was living in Sydney. So it was nice to reconnect with him over the phone, and good on him for, I don't know, reaching out the olive branch himself. And that sort of, for me, showed a lot of growth. And I was just proud of him for doing that.
Back to Harry in a moment. Next up on the show, and what a privilege to have this man join us, the 47th Test captain of Australia, Pat Cummins. Now, Pat made his Test debut at age 18 after only three games of Sheffield Shield cricket. And Pat, well, he walked into a dressing room full of his idols.
Finished school, had no, you know, big aspirations in cricket, but nothing, like, didn't think I would ever. It was a creeper. Didn't even comprehend that it would be. And then within a couple of weeks, I was playing for New South Wales. I thought, oh, geez, this, like, I might not have to get a job here. And then within a couple of weeks later, I basically had an Aussie contract. And none of it really felt real. Like, I felt I was going to get the tap on the shoulder and kind of be like, come on, mate, like, the jig's up.
You're not meant to be here, mate.
Yeah. And I remember it wasn't until I was in the Aussie dressing room and I look around and it's, whatever, it was November, and I was like, I should be in school here. Like, this is school time. Wow. For the last 20 years, you know, 15 years. And I was like, okay, there's Punter there. There's Mike Hussey there. There's Pup Clark there. There's Brad Haddon. There's Mitchell Johnson. And I was going around it all. I'm like, wow, this is the Aussie team. And then, you know, Punter presented my baggy green, and my first thought, I remember this so clearly, was, wow, like, I've fooled them all. And they can't take this back. They've given it, like, I thought up until that point, it's like, okay, yeah, you know, the jig's up. Come on, off you get. And I was like, once they give the baggy green, I was like, wow, this is serious.
That is the superstar that is Pat Cummins, next up on the show. Let's get back to Harry. Boxing. I don't make many notes, but I make sure I want to get this right. So we'll skip ahead a little bit. So at what stage, you talked about your first national title at age...
18, yeah.
So at this stage, do you think maybe I can make a career out of this? Was it in your mind since you were nine?
Yeah, it was interesting. I think the goalposts have always just changed, and I think that always happens with the world we live in. It's just like, well, it's the if and when type mindset. You mean when I win that, then I'll be complete, or then I'll feel happy, or whatever, then I'll be content. For me, it was to win the state title, the Victorian state title. I finally won my first one when I was 14.
Yep.
And then I tried really hard to win a nationals, and I didn't get that for another 4 years until I was 18. Then after that, it was like, well, let's try and make the Olympics. You mean, I really wanted to make the Olympic team. I didn't make that in 2016. I finally qualified for the Commonwealth Games. And it's just constantly the goalposts are always changing. And I probably didn't believe that I could do something with it. Like, I would always say it and I'd be training and I really wanted to, but I don't think I believed it until the 2018 Commonwealth Games. And to bring home a gold medal on home soil was an amazing thing. But that was probably where I started going, wow, okay. Uh-huh. Now I actually might be able to do this. Yeah.
So when you talk about you had all the Olympians on your wall, what's it like? Like, is there a kit day where you go and get your kit, or does it get sent to you? The first time you whack the senior national colours on, like, I always think it must be like Christmas when there's boxes of gear everywhere and you put it on for the first time.
Yeah, it's definitely something that I know a lot of athletes love, and I'm the exact same. I love it. I look at everything, and it's just – I think it's an amazing moment, you mean, where we're all, well, I can only speak for myself, but I'm just a little kid, even still at the age of 25, who just loves sport. And to be surrounded by people at the Olympic Games like Paddy Mills,
Top five people I've had on the show. I
reckon. He's an amazing man.
He should end up running this country.
Oh, I actually believe that. There was one moment.
He should be the Prime Minister at some point.
Yeah, there was one moment, and I pride myself on having him in like old school values and then being sort of quite chivalrous. And he sort of put me to shame. I mean, I was like really had to – it was at the opening ceremony, and I was with three of the boy boxers, including myself, and I we went up to Kate Campbell and Patty Mills. I'm like, hey, can we get a photo? Kate Campbell was sitting on a chair because she was competing very shortly.
Yeah.
And Patty was like, oh, don't get up, don't get up. We can get a photo sitting down. But she got up, being the generous human that she is, and we got a photo. But I was like, in that moment, I didn't even cross my mind. Right. That's the type of man Patty Mills is. So
it's a great description.
Absolutely. And he's just an exceptional human, does a lot for obviously the community and just for the country in general. I think he's just an exceptional man.
So Commonwealth Games, firefights, as you said. You come up against the Indian and then a split decision. So it's tight. And I've looked back at all your fights in the last 48 hours in between the cricket. You're wearing blue, and then that's how you find out, because they say, and the winner in the blue corner, and your face lights up like it's lighting up now. What is that moment like?
To your winner from the blue corner.
That's still to date the proudest moment for me.
It was bloody good.
It was an extremely close fight. We've fought each other twice, and we've done a lot of sparring. Me and Manash Kaushik from India.
Yep,
we're one apiece.
Right,
one apiece. But he's an exceptional fighter, and just to get that on home soil, and I was only 20 years old, very young, and just that elation that. If you could bottle that moment up and drink a sip a day, it would be electric. But it was amazing. And then to run to my mates from Lilydale, probably on TV pouring beer over my head.
Good Lilydale, man.
And then run to the other side of the venue where my parents were, and just to hug them. All three of us were just bawling our eyes out. And it was just amazing, to be completely honest. There's no other words for it.
Harry Garside. Been training since he was 9 years of age, and here he is with a gold medal around his neck in front of his home crowd.
What do you think it meant? You've talked about your mum, but what do you think it meant to your dad? Because you went there to prove something to him when you were 9 years of age.
Yeah, he's the proudest dad on earth. He always wears the Team Garside jumpers. Every time I'm down in Melbourne, he's always wearing the Team Garside jumper down to Bunnings or down to the shops. He bloody loves it. But yeah, he's just... To share that moment with him, and of course my mum as well, was just amazing. And it's quite interesting. I've battled a fair bit of, it's like every parent wants their kid to be safe.
Yes.
Every parent wants their kid to sort of be secure. And it's like for me, I don't think they believe that I could make a living out of this. And they're always saying, just get a job or get a uni degree or do something, because then you'll be
something
safe. It's a sort of secondary plan and a plan B. But Arnold Schwarzenegger, I saw this quote when I was really young, and he said, don't have a plan B because it takes away your focus from plan A. So, and I agree with that, but I think that moment was probably a moment as well where we realized, wow, my son actually might be able to do something here. And it was almost like the, I don't know if you ever read the Green Lights, Matthew McConaughey's book. It's fantastic, where his brother beats his dad up.
Yep.
And his dad gets up and they shake hands and they're equals. It was like a moment like that for myself, and it was beautiful.
While we're swapping books, have you read Arnold Schwarzenegger's book? I think it's called Total Recall. And oh mate.
Exceptional.
We talked about Andre Agassi, because he starts life as the world's best bodybuilder. So that's a book in itself.
Mm.
And then the next third is the world's biggest movie star, book in itself. And then the next third is being governor of California, book in itself. So, unbelievable, unbelievable book. I'm going to send it to you. You'll absolutely love it. We mentioned discipline, and obviously a big part of your story is you do things differently, which is why I think you've had a massive impact. You'll hear the question from my daughter soon on especially young people. But the challenges you set yourself... Fascinate me. Tell me about what you call them and what do they do for you before what they are. What do they do for you in the ring?
Yeah, so when I was 2018, just after the Commonwealth Games, we did this program called the Gold Medal Ready Program, and it was with the Australian Institute of Sport and the Gold the Commander Regiment, the Army, and they put us through 3 days of just hard work. I love hard work, but those 3 days were very full on, and treading water for 90 minutes fully closed and stuff like that. It was really testing us mentally. But we learned in that, the biggest thing I learned from those 3 days was get comfortable being uncomfortable. And you want to grow as an athlete.
So just so people get that, get comfortable being uncomfortable.
Yeah. And that's coming from people who go to war.
Yes.
The most vulnerable state you can be as a human is going to war. And we learned a lot. And from that day, I started, that was end of 2018, but from that day, since the start of 2019, January 2019, I've been doing a challenge once a month for the last, 3-4 years. It's been amazing. A lot of fun. There's been some challenges that have been really challenging and some challenges that have just been a bit of fun and also still made me uncomfortable. But watching my growth and as a person more so than an athlete has been amazing. I've obviously improved a lot as a boxer in that time as well. But it's just exciting. You mean? So I heard this famous quote. It's I actually don't know who it's by, but there's no proof in this world to prove that this life is serious.
Hmm.
You mean? And often as humans, we're so focused, and I can't talk. I'm an athlete. I'm focused on results and goals. But to do something once a month that's outside of boxing that I know will also improve my boxing and my life, it's just a lot of fun. A lot of fun.
So it's a great thing because. And I appreciate it. The first thing you walked in here when we met, you asked me about my children. I see my children aged 11 now and 13 have to go through something uncomfortable 3 times a month because they're hitting the first whatever it is, facing their first bouncer in the nets, giving their first speech in front of school, having to put it on the line in a cross country, going to a new school, which my young fella's about to do. And they become so accustomed to it, it doesn't seem a challenge. And then as we get older, I'd be interested in people listening to this, if they actually ask themselves, when were they last truly uncomfortable? I think a lot of people would have problems answering that question.
Yeah, I personally think it's actually human behaviour. I think I've really pondered this because I've caught myself.
It's a good word, pondered.
Yeah, thank you. Pondered. I've really thought about that as humans. It's our duty, I think, on this earth is to survive. We're survival beings. And I think any area that we can get comfortable so we don't have to exert energy for survival, then we will.
Yes.
And that's why the Western world is so expansive. And a lot of the time we're chilling at home and it's just we need to be in our safe space. We don't want to put ourselves in uncomfortable situations. But I truly believe the places where you'll grow are the places where you're most uncomfortable. And Ned Brockman, the great man, Ned Brockman, yes. He would get comfortable being uncomfortable. Yes. Is the thing that he slogan for the run. And I truly believe that. And for some people, it would be different. I actually don't know what will make you uncomfortable. A lot of things are very similar, like public speaking is a pretty common one. Dance class is a common one. It could be as little as having a conversation with someone you love and expressing exactly how you're feeling or something like that. It could be a vulnerable one like that. But I've found myself, anyone who listens to this, if they've got any ideas, feel free to message
me.
Send them through because it's been 4 years and I'm actually really, there's still a few things on the list of things to do. The more ideas, the better.
So give me some examples where you have been really uncomfortable.
50 hours no talking was a challenging one.
50 hours no talking. You're a man that likes to talk.
Yeah, I love to talk.
Did you lock yourself away from people?
It was prior to the Olympics, so I was through an Olympic preparation. The only time I could talk, so it was about 4 weeks prior to the Tokyo Olympics, and we were in Japan at the time. And the only time I could talk was to my coach during a training session. That's the only time I could talk in that 50 hours, but that was only during sparring. Any other time I didn't talk. So it was super challenging. And probably every challenge I learned something new from about myself or about the world. And what I realized is that I take up a lot of space because I feel very comfortable to talk and I express my energy through talk. And what I found in that was when I shut my mouth, other people, the wallflowers in the group, they had to fill the space. They then had an opportunity to talk. And from that day, I found myself catch myself going, Harry, you're talking too much. So then I pull back and try my best to give other people the opportunity or bring them in myself, saying, hey, if they look a bit sort of on the outskirts or something like that, try and bring them into the conversation. And yeah, it's like every challenge is different. Some are harder than others, but yeah, each one I learned something new from.
There's a theory that, again, I'm not good with my quotes, but there's a theory that when you're talking, you can't be learning, which I enjoy. Okay, so no talk for 50 hours. Give me another example.
13 hours straight on a stationary bike in quarantine was challenging.
13 hours straight on a bike?
On a bike, yeah, just kept going. Yeah, that was more so physical. I did 100Ks in the sand last month, but the physical ones personally.
Although 100Ks in the sand?
On the sand, on Bondi Beach, yeah. It was.
What do you mean, walking?
Running. Yeah.
Running?
Yeah, it took 13 hours, yeah.
100K?
100K.
Up and down?
Up and down,
from North Bondi to South Bondi?
Yeah, it's about 950 metres, so. 110, 120.
Oh, I have a car.
The Achilles are the worst. Oh, yeah. They're still recovering. Right. That was a few weeks ago. But physical feats, like we're athletes. I mean, I love pushing myself. There's a beauty in that. Of course, I wanted to give up and I wanted to throw the towel in, but to finish it was amazing. But I think personally, the ones for me where I'm most uncomfortable, most vulnerable is having the conversations with the people you love. Like if me and my dad were in a bad spot for a very, very long time, me coming of age and sort of challenging him on everything that he said and him going through a son battling with drug addiction and him also finding purpose outside of his family and stuff like that. Many things played into that moment. But to one of my first challenges I did, I think it was in June of 2019, so about 6 months in, was sit down with my dad and have a conversation. And it was...
How'd you bring it up with him?
I wrote on a card. It was about a week before his birthday. And I wrote on a card saying, I can't remember the exact words, but it was, let's sort it out. Let's go have breakfast or a coffee and let's sort this out. And when I gave it to him, I said, I miss my dad. That's what I said. I miss my dad. And his bottom lip just quivers. Oh, it always does. Yeah, it was a beautiful moment. And we just went and spoke and we realized that, like, we were just arguing about different things and because we weren't communicating properly. But, yeah, that was beautiful. Another one was no technology for a month. That was a tough one.
That would be hard.
Yeah, no phone, no watch, no laptop, no TV.
Before. Did you miss it?
I found myself not feeling very connected, which is a weird thing. I feel like more young people are going to feel like that. I found myself not connected to my mates. I found myself having to go to their house the old-fashioned way and they might not be home and a lot of the time they weren't home. So I felt a bit disconnected, but then also realizing that social media, it just also is you might feel connected, but like do you actually need to have your notifications on? There's so many things about social media that you could probably adapt a little bit.
How do you reckon your dad walked away from the conversation he had with you? Like it's normally... If you follow the stereotypes, which you obviously do not do, he's coming to you and saying, Harry, we need to sit down.
Mm. Yeah, it was – I found myself throughout my life, and I'm not trying to big note myself here, but it's that I've always tried to sort of throw out the olive branch myself I've probably in the last few years, you sort of – once you get rejected enough times, when you're a kid, you can get away with it. Once you get rejected enough times, then you've got to overcome the fear of that. But when I was younger, probably from maybe 14 to 21, I would always be trying to patch relationships up, friendships up, family relationships up. It was to have that and reach out the olive branch myself. And my dad is just a super loving, caring man. I know he loves us more than he loves himself. He just has a weird way of showing it sometimes.
It's remarkable depth of understanding from you when you don't have kids. So I was on New Year's Eve, we were with some local friends, Cam and Eva Don, great people, local Barwon Heads people. And they've got a son, Taji Boy, who I've seen at the cricket club since he was 8. He's now 15 and he's going out with his mates on New Year's Eve. And as he walked out, we were having a barbecue. His dad said, take it easy, mate. And he said, love your dad. And I thought to myself, as a parent, if my son at 15 says he loves me as he walks out the door, when people ask, what do you want to achieve as a parent? I reckon that's it. Mm. So it's pretty special that you can go to your old man and tee that up.
Yeah, it's me and my dad always have little special moments now. I never saw him cry up until the age, I think it was about 17. The Reach Foundation, massive part of my story. I don't know if you've ever heard of it or your listeners.
Jimmy Steins.
Yeah, Jimmy Steins Foundation.
Explain it though.
Yeah, it's a youth organisation and they mostly operate from 12-year-olds to about 18-year-olds. They go to a lot of school workshops. They do camps on weekends and stuff like that, community engagement programs. But they come to my school when I was 16 and in that time I was at a point where I was at a bit of a crossroads. Do I continue with boxing? Didn't have a lot of success, and am I good enough? All these thoughts. All my mates started partying on the weekends and stuff like that. Do I go down that path? But yeah, they enter my life at that time at the crossroads, and the universe works in a weird, wonderful way, and they truly changed the trajectory of my life. And I think a year after being involved with them, I won my first nationals, and yeah, the rest is history, I guess. But one of the first ones that we had the training session, one of the first training sessions I went to, they said, all right, we're going to leave this stage open. There's about 50 crew member there from Reach. And they said, if you feel this feeling in your gut of uncomfortableness, the butterflies, you can get up and do anything you want. You could sing a song. You could call someone and tell them you loved them. You could do anything. The stage is yours. But if you feel that feeling, that's a sign that you need to get up. And I was sitting there going, oh my God, oh my God, it's my first one. I feel like it's a bit of initiation. So yeah. I got up and my family don't really tell each other we love them, but we all know. And I called my mom and I told her I loved her. And it was just an amazing moment to say that to the ones you love. My mom did reply saying, are you all good? but yeah, it was just a beautiful moment. And I'm so grateful I'm at the Reach Foundation.
That is the end of Harry Garside Part A. Do not, whatever you do, be missing Part B.